Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. A word on our other sponsor, Bremont, an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers, designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by our title partner, the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. When we think of immense wealth creation, we might think of the satisfaction derived from years of hard work, but less about the complexities and challenges that significant wealth brings. And as Richard Branson has observed, for a successful entrepreneur, it may mean extreme wealth, but with extreme wealth comes extreme responsibility. Over recent decades, a whole industry has been built around wealth management, with most large financial institutions jostling for a share of the opportunities. Less public, however, has been the growth of the family office business, established by or for wealth creators to oversee, structure, and deploy the assets for them and their beneficiaries. Some represent single families, other multi-families. Recent data indicate that family offices now control in excess of $4 trillion, and according to the Global Wealth Report from Credit Suisse, there are now currently 47 million millionaires, accounting for almost 44% of the world's total wealth. So to examine one such organization's philosophy, proposition, and approach, I'm delighted to have the founding partner of Capital Generation Partners, Charlotte Thorne, as my guest today. Charlotte, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon.
Well, we like to start with dialing back. Tell me a little bit about how your childhood shaped you.
Let me take myself back. So I grew up in a London suburb, Teddington. I'm one of three girls. So that's been quite formative in my life to have sisters alongside me all the way. I suppose the significant thing that happened in my childhood was that my parents got divorced quite early on in the 70s. That set a path for all three of us, actually. It was both of my parents were extremely clear the whole way through that financial independence was absolutely essential. So there was never any question that we would be getting out there and earning our own living and never, ever, ever giving up those reins unless we absolutely had to. And all these years on, we are still actively building careers. And it's certainly something I would want to pass on to my children as well. You know, not that they will have a choice in the matter, but I do think financial independence and having the means to look after yourself and your own family is actually really important. It's definitely a message I would pass on to girls.
So you obviously study well or study successfully and you get to Oxford. Was that an obvious choice or did you balance a number of possibilities?
Going to university was not a question for us. Again, my parents and particularly my dad were very clear, you will be going to university. But it wasn't something that he had done. And it wasn't particularly something that the family were very knowledgeable about. I suppose what I was really interested in was ideas around philosophy and politics. And somehow I heard about PPE and I thought, well, perhaps I'll give that a go, without actually really knowing very much about it at all. So applying was a bit of a long shot. And in fact, when I told my grandmother that I'd got into Oxford, she thought I had a job there. That was where it was on our family radar. But of course, it has been a sort of transformational experience for me going to Oxford. And when I look back on it, I think actually I got in a little bit by fortune, but also because I was probably working 10% harder than the other kids. Now it's a very different challenge to get into one of those universities. And at a certain point, it has to become a lottery. And I do actually feel for the universities in having to try and work out how to balance all these incredible candidates that they must see.
Yes. Well, we could have a long conversation about that, particularly in light of the more controversial elements of these university intakes and how they're going about it. But we're going to leave that for another day. On leaving Oxford, you have to decide on a career and you opt for government, the public sector versus private sector. I wonder how you thought about that.
My interest really was in policy. So I don't know if you've seen Hamilton, but the song about being in the room where it happens really sums it up for me, that actually when you are working in central government, particularly if you're working in a department like the Treasury, you are in the room where it happens. You may not be the one making the decision. You're not Alexander Hamilton, but you are exposed to some extraordinary moments and some really important decisions. And I wouldn't have wanted to have missed out on that.
And when you reflect back, were there some particularly valuable lessons that you learned?
Well, the great thing about working in the Treasury is it's quite a small department, actually, considering how significant it is. And what that means is, as really quite a young person, you have fantastic exposure to the most senior people in the country. So it happened that I was working on pensions. And quite a lot of the time, that's quite boring, particularly if you're working on SERPs policy, which is one of the technical things I was working on. It's quite boring. It's not really in the spotlight. And then all of a sudden, it came into the spotlight. It became highly political. This was in the early years of the Blair government, and pensioner poverty was suddenly on everybody's minds and everybody was concerned. And if you are that person and that's your policy, you'll get a call from the Chancellor's office and you need to run along to the Chancellor's office and you better know what you're talking about when you get there. The Chancellor obviously was Gordon Brown at the time, and he is a somewhat terrifying person, as you can probably tell, but also a very impressive person. So you find yourself in that spotlight needing to provide advice and information and clarity in a very stressful and high profile set of discussions. And that's quite bracing. And you quickly learn to get good at expressing what you need to express clearly and succinctly and with a degree of perhaps certainty and conviction. But at the same time, bearing in mind, you're the servant. You're the civil servant, and it's not your job to make the decision. That has been useful for me ever since, I think. One might say getting used to working with really powerful people is useful when you end up working in the family office.
So it's interesting. You've almost preempted a question which I just couldn't resist, and that's that between 1999 and 2002, Gordon Brown arrived at this decision to sell half of the UK's gold. It was, at the time, in my opinion, an extraordinary foolish decision. I railed against it at the time. We were buying gold when I was then at Morgan Stanley. How do you separate your own views from the need to execute orders?
Yeah, it's a good question. So my sister is a criminal defence barrister, and it's a question that she gets asked often. How do you separate the emotion of this particular case and what this person may have done with the fact that your job is to defend them? And I think the answer is professionalism. That is the job you are there to do. You're not supposed to be hedging your bets and giving a sort of nuanced, muddled view. You're supposed to be giving a very clear direction. And if the minister decides not to go in that direction, that is their privilege as the elected representative. And I never found that difficult, actually. There's a very strong professional ethos in the civil service. It's what the civil service stands for. And I would defend that really to the hilt, actually.
However, you moved from the public to the private sector. Tell me how that shift came along.
Well, that was a really interesting and surprising step in a way. What happened was I'd been in the Treasury for a few years And then I went to the FSA, as it was then. I didn't actually enjoy that as much. And I happened upon a job ad. And this job ad in the Sunday Times said, we are looking for civil servants who can speak French, who know a bit about finance. And obviously, this is not a collection of skills that most people are looking for. So I thought, okay, better ring up and find out about this. And what was interesting was, I remember speaking to the headhunter, and she said to me, this is very interesting. It's a family office, and it's an incredible opportunity because they have racehorses and artworks and houses. It's just an incredible opportunity. And my first thought was, I don't know what you're talking about. Number one, I don't know what a family office is. And number two, I've got no interest in racehorses and artworks and any of that. My job is policy and thinking about how to create sensible policies around consumer financial products. Why would this be of any interest to me? And actually, I was kind of deciding not to go to this interview. I did go. That was almost 20 years ago now. I met the family in question. And I came away thinking, okay, I still really don't know what a family office is, and I still really don't know what you're doing, but I'm really interested in you. And I'm really interested in your sophistication and your intelligence, and you're working on things that I would like to know more about. And I'm also really engaged by your integrity. So this is not what I thought it was going to be. I don't quite know what it is, but it's not what I thought it was going to be. And that was the start. And the job was working in the family office in Switzerland. And three of us went out to work in this family office in Switzerland. In fact, two of us have a civil service background. So it was obviously a propitious route for the family at the time. And we ended up building an investment program for this family, ultra high net worth family, with really significant wealth to invest. And what was interesting to us as outsiders, none of us had come from the asset management sector, was, if you think about, let's say you have $1 billion to invest, as an outsider, you would assume that what you're going to be offered by the financial services sector is something really significantly different to what you'd be offered as a bulge bracket, high net worth, almost retail individual. And the truth was, it wasn't that different. It was product, and it was sale, and it was fees. It was surprisingly poor quality. So we set about building an investment program that we felt was better, directly with funds and managers that we felt the family should have access to. And we did that for 3 years. And then the interesting and useful thing that happened was that Barton Biggs was on the family's investment board at the time. And Barton Biggs, obviously, as you know, is a really significant name in the investment world. And he said, I think you have something interesting to say, and I think you should look at doing it independently. So we did. So we came back to the UK in 2007, set up the firm. And I suppose the first several years were around getting the structures right, getting the platform right, getting FSA as it was then, and then SEC registration, getting all of that right, getting the reporting systems right, and really sort of building the machinery that we felt families like this should have access to. In retrospect, what we would probably all say is that we had the idea that if we build something with a really strong set of processes, really excellent people in the firm, doing something really quite distinctive, then clients would come. And in retrospect, I think that was the bit where we were kind of a bit naive about how it actually works. And we were a bit slow to develop our sales function properly. I think I can say we have since fixed that. It's not sufficient for us to just have an exceptional service in the world. We have to get out and tell people about it. And that was possibly a thing that we took a little bit too long to learn.
Well, for those who don't know, Barton Biggs was Morgan Stanley's global strategist. He was an inspiration for me personally, and he wrote a very good book that I actually used in a talk at the LSE the other day, which is called Wealth, War and Wisdom. And he shows some fantastic data on why the UK stock market bottomed, the FT30 bottomed even in the Second World War, even before Hitler had met any resistance in 1940. So anyway, we'll have that as an attachment in our show notes. So Charlotte, I'm interested on your perspective on why a very wealthy individual might join a multi-family office established by another wealthy individual with their own preferences and architecture, as opposed to doing it oneself?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And it's actually something that we thought about at the beginning of our journey. So we have a number of clients who said to us, yes, we'd like to work with you, but only if we can have effectively almost exactly what you're doing for client A. And that's not something that we were anticipating, actually. Not all clients say that. Some clients want something completely distinct and obviously sort of paying attention to their own investment needs and their own investment thesis. But a number of clients have wanted it that way round. And that was a surprise to us. I think why you wouldn't necessarily set up a family office of your own. Well, for a start, I think if you want an investment office which is going to cover all the asset classes as broadly as you probably need to and have the institutional quality of analysis and reporting, it probably doesn't make much sense for much less than $500 million. And that's a lot of money. And even once you've done that and you've got that underway, there's just the ongoing challenge of running a business, which you just may simply not want to do. One of the biggest challenges, I think, is you're going to hire these really fantastically talented people and you're going to set them to work on these sort of interesting challenges. And then you've got to retain them, and you've got to retain them by providing them with some sort of career path. And in a small family office, that's quite difficult to achieve. So providing a career path and building a robust and resilient business, I think, is really one of the challenges that gets overlooked.
Which, of course, leads to the question, which is, how did you think about building an investment team to be able to look after these investors?
Yeah, I suppose we've done a couple of things which might be reasonably distinctive. One is that we haven't hired all that much from the banking sector. I say that because I've interviewed tens, hundreds, probably, of really talented, mainly young people coming out of the banking sector. What I recall about those interactions is just a sense of disappointment from these incredibly talented young people who'd aced every exam they'd ever done and gone into the banking sector because they thought they were going to be dealing with investment challenges and actually found they were there to sell product. We don't need people who have been taught how to sell the product. We need people who can think from first principles. The other thing is, we don't want people to come in and have an expertise in, let's say it's hedge funds, and let's say you're the macro hedge funds guy, but we don't think in asset allocation terms that this is the right time to be invested in macro hedge funds. We didn't want to set up that tension so that someone is always trying to push their asset class and we're having to sort of hold them back and say, no, not yet, not yet. And when you're doing that, well, then what is that person supposed to do with their life? They've been told that their asset class is not of any interest. I mean, as it happens at the moment, macro is of interest. But the point is generally that we didn't want people to have this sort of zero-sum mentality where their asset class was what mattered. What we wanted them to be thinking of was in terms of how would an investor view this set of opportunities and where would they best allocate their marginal dollar? And that does require a slightly different set of characteristics. And I think it also requires some quite sophisticated people skills in there to be able to understand that, okay, I've spent all this time researching the best frontier manager and the team have decided this is not the right time for frontier, but I'm going to keep those relationships going. And I've done this work in good faith and I have trust and respect in the process that when the time is right, this work will come to fruition. So I think that's two quite distinctive characteristics that we've looked for. And it has created, I think, quite a distinctive investment process and probably quite distinctive investment portfolios as well.
So let's just stay with that hedge fund question for a moment, because I was involved in a beauty parade for a client I do some work with the other day, and we had two very large, well-known financial institutions, one who argued that hedge funds had lost their alpha and they no longer included them in an asset allocation, and another firm who argued exactly the opposite. Where do you sit at the moment?
We certainly have some clients who don't want any hedge funds in their portfolio. They've just been along that path for a long time with hedge funds and finally I'm just fed up of paying these fees. Other clients who are happy to have hedge funds, we don't have many clients who are thrilled and excited about hedge funds. So as I've said, many of our clients don't want hedge funds in their portfolios. Those that still do use them as diversifying strategies. We're not particularly using them as return generators right now. We're using them as diversifying strategies. And there is a really important case in a well-balanced portfolio for adding some carefully chosen hedge fund strategies. But I think we have gone a little bit full circle on this. Some of the bigger hedge funds had sort of particularly suffered, perhaps with a bit of hubris. What we see now is that some of the bigger hedge funds are beginning to regroup and build something quite interesting and quite successful, particularly in terms of developing multi-strategy underneath the umbrella of one single hedge fund. That's an interesting place to be, not always easy to get access to, and you're not going to have that much control over the fees that you pay when you're talking with these really big hedge funds. But I nevertheless think they do have a useful role to play. So for now, this plays in a little bit to the active passive issue, but for now, passive investment is potentially a more difficult path to follow. And therefore, there is a case to say maybe more active management, maybe hedge funds will be able to get you through this, frankly, what might be quite challenging period of time ahead of us.
Well, I was thinking as we had that exchange that the problem in a market that's been so strong, where clearly beta has been everything, is that you haven't wanted your portfolio manager to be reducing beta and having hedges on the other side. But if we end up in a much more turbulent environment, maybe it's actually going to be a much more propitious environment for hedge funds. And we had Pete Davis from Lansdowne on the podcast a couple of weeks ago and talking about a number of the strategies that they manage. So we are often conditioned by the most recent experiences, and the last decade has definitely ushered in a anti-hedge fund climate. Let's just stay with that active versus passive debate. How would you think about it and explain your view to a client?
We very much try to be not partisan on the active-passive debate. However, we do have a specific view at a specific point in time. And one way to think about that specific view is to think about the who and the where and the when of active versus passive. So in terms of the who, I think it is difficult to find active managers who outperform net of fees. They really don't all manage to achieve that. And if you're a retail investor, I think it's really difficult to identify who can and who can't sustainably over time outperform net of fees. I think for professional investors who have access to a big bank of analysts and researchers who will sort of delve into the numbers, it's potentially easier. So that's the who. The where is, I think we know, and this is pretty consistent, that private equity, for example, is going to reward active management. That's in the nature of the business. There's such huge dispersion in private equity returns. You're going to want to be active, probably the same in frontier markets. The when is more nuanced. And for us, the when is actually, I think, active will return more over this kind of coming period of time compared to passive. Expected returns are so low, you're going to have to work harder and pay more to achieve the returns you want. Dispersion of outcomes is going to be really broad. We know, even just from a sort of geography and sector point of view, countries are coming out of the pandemic at different points and in different shape. I think the other thing to think about is that indices are going to be somewhat risky depending on how you select them. So if you think about an emerging markets index, it's going to be very concentrated in China. If you think about a developed markets index, maybe a sort of US equity markets index, it's going to be overweight to tech. It's going to be concentrated. And so if you are just following passive benchmarks and passive investment strategy, you are going to find yourself overly concentrated in places where you don't necessarily want to be overly concentrated.
So you alluded to China, and maybe we'll just pause on China, because there we have a growing representation in an index, but a lot of political noise and discomfort in some quarters around that. You've suggested you're very good at being objective, given your history of working in government. But when you are thinking about China, how do you balance those forces?
I think really taking a step back, we're clearly moving away from a world where the US was the sort of unipolar power towards a bipolar or a multipolar global economy. I think that's undeniable. And probably overall, most Western investors are overallocated to the US compared to where they will be in 10 or 20 years' time. So I think the shift of assets at the margins will happen in that direction from the US to China. And that's going to have an impact, obviously, on what happens to the value of Chinese assets when you're just sort of on the ground trying to find the right manager. The other thing that's happening is that all major economies are struggling with some of the same issues around how do we deal with inequality? How do we deal with low wage growth? How do we deal with the challenge of the tech entrepreneurs who have potentially such overweening powers. These are the same issues affecting every government of whatever type. And I think what's happening is that each government is addressing these challenges in a way that is perfectly familiar to that government and to that government's people, and perfectly foreign to everyone who's foreign to that government and that people. Our view about how you should play China, and again, this is somewhat easier for professional investors than for retail investors, is that you really need local managers. You cannot do this through vehicles that are particularly targeting foreign investors. They probably run out of New York or run out of London. You need the local knowledge. I think it would be remiss not to have any allocation to China. And it's something that we're looking to grow. But as I say, it's really quite challenging to do when we're allowed to travel. We have to send people to China for quite long periods of time, finding the right local managers.
Well, it's interesting, behind the noise, I was looking at some of the valuation data, and in many cases, some of these Chinese and Hong Kong names have got valuation levels that we haven't seen since the Asian financial crisis. So back to CapGen, as you call Capital Generation Partners today. Tell me about the firm's philosophy.
We're approaching $4 billion in assets under management. We have 24 clients. So that averages out at about $150 million per client. So that sort of gives you a little bit the sense of scale, although there are some super large in there and then some just extremely, extremely large families in there. The important thing for us about the way we do it is that there isn't one single model. So every client has their own very specific portfolio. And that's really one of the things we were trying to achieve for this client base, which is, if you have wealth at this level, you should be serviced at an institutional level.
So I'm going to dive into that a little bit more in a minute, but I noticed as I went through your documents that you have a line which is, we help families make the most of the possibilities that come with capital. There are lots of strap lines in financial services. I'm going to embarrass a friend of mine who once announced, he said, not knowingly, money talks, but wealth whispers. And I reminded him that he goes through Geneva Airport a lot, and that was the advert for Citibank. He's a podcast listener of ours. He may not be listening to it after this, but he knows who he is. Tell me what you mean by, we help families make the most of the possibilities that come with capital.
I suppose one of the things that we're trying to achieve for our clients is that they come at their wealth in many, many different ways. So many of them have an operating business still, and that's their number one day job and the thing that keeps them up at night. And the wealth that they've accumulated is actually something that just needs to be dealt with. And it's something that for them, they want organized and managed and sorted. And then for other families, the wealth and the business of the management of wealth is central to what they do all day, every day. And they want to be actively engaged in it. And they want an active engagement with us. And then again, for other families, they want to go away and do something different. They want to be liberated to go and live a different kind of life. And they want to know that their wealth manager, whoever it may be, is looking after this issue for them so that they are liberated to go and do what it is they want, whatever that may be. So I suppose one of our jobs is to find out where our families are on that spectrum and to meet them there. So what I mean by that is, we have clients who want to engage with us daily on what's in their portfolios, on meeting the managers, on discussing the individual positions that a particular fund might be taking around inflation, let's say, and other families who really don't and who want to make use of their capital in a very different way. And our job is just to meet them wherever they are. So when we say make use of the possibilities that come with capital, it's actually about liberating each group of individuals to really have the life that they want to have. We're all familiar with the concept of wealth becoming something of a problem to people. And of course, for many people, that seems an extraordinary statement, but it's also something that you can see very, very vividly out there in the real world. If you have inherited wealth, and you perhaps have inherited a group of advisors as well, lawyers and accountants and trustees. The money is in a trust. There are trustees effectively controlling what happens with your wealth. All of those individuals are there for good reason, but it can be incredibly alienating and disempowering for people. So we've certainly seen situations like that where people feel disempowered by the structures around their wealth. And that's a very odd position to be in, isn't it? Because really the whole point of money is to liberate.
Yes. Does great wealth liberate or does it constrain you? It's a really important question. And let's talk about the fact that you design and develop the firm's discretionary platform. So how would you summarize the investment approach and, if you like, the investment toolbox that you developed?
I think the important thing about the way we've chosen to do it is that our investment approach is a process. So for me, the most important thing about the way we do things is that it is a process. So the way we actually do it is that we have an asset allocation process, which is taking different feeds from the world and trying to identify where we think assets would be best placed in the coming period of time. And separately, we have an origination team whose job is to be out there looking for what we think are the very best managers in whatever asset class they are specialist in. And then the key, I think, is to have the cold-bloodedness to be able to only invest in those managers when the time is right. So it's a process. It's a series of long-term relationships with managers that we know and trust over the period of time, but it's a trust but verify situation.
So you build a process whose aim essentially is capital preservation. And I'm going to add, although it may be obvious, in real terms, that's the great challenge. And if we are having a shift in epoch from one where inflation has been your friend to something that becomes slightly less benign, how do you make sure that process isn't so rigid? Is there a tactical overlay? How do you sit around the table and think about a shift in the world order, which is the history of investing cycles?
Yes, and at the moment it's particularly important because I think we all sense that we might be at the beginning of a secular change, but it's too soon to say definitively that that is the case. So our portfolios at the moment are positioned for inflation on balance. The way we would put it is you need to be on the dance floor right now, but with your eyes on the exits. I think dynamic asset allocation is really the key here. And one of the other things I think is important to say to clients is, let's say you have a 4% real return target. I think it's important for clients to understand that that doesn't mean what we and other sensible investment managers will be trying to achieve is 4% every year, tick, tick, tick. That just doesn't exist. That's not available in the market. What a dynamic asset allocation will try to do for you is to achieve, let's say, 3% real return in the years when you're not going to be rewarded for taking extra risk, but then move up to 6% when you are going to be rewarded. And over the long term, we are going to try to average out for you at around 4%.
One of the issues we all grapple with is the illiquidity premium, I think originally coined by the late David Swensen, of being rewarded by being in investments that are less liquid. And yet Barton Biggs in his book actually highlights the point that liquidity is often undervalued by the extremely wealthy, and it's the crises that highlight it, not, of course, when everything seems to be absolutely fine.
I think that's right. But I think liquidity is undervalued. Private equity funds tend to work on a kind of 3 to 5 year cycle. But for the super wealthy families, that's actually too short a time horizon. And they are able to lock up for a bit longer. The fund market doesn't necessarily provide for that right now. And we understand why that is. It's not necessarily easy to do that in a fund structure that's going to be commingling. But I think for super wealthy families, there is an increasing interest in looking at opportunities for permanent capital vehicles that lock up liquidity for a bit longer. So I think it's two sides of the coin, really. One is for individuals and families to really understand what liquidity they will need and to absolutely prepare for that. Because when you have a mismatch between your liquidity needs and the volatility in the market, that's your disaster scenario. I mean, that's when you're going to get permanent capital loss, having to draw down at the worst possible moment. And that is a cardinal sin in investment management.
But staying with the illiquid space and private equity particularly, in the Canadian pension industry, we've started to see some of the large investors allocate directly to private ventures. And I wondered, sitting where you are, whether there's any sense of you looking at that.
Absolutely. We have a portfolio side of our business, which is basically centered around funds. But we also have a direct investing strand in our business. And that's because families like this will have a portfolio which is around capital preservation and targeted, reasonably regimented return kind of trajectory. But they will also have direct investments, sometimes because they've come from a business-owning heritage, and that's fundamentally what's interesting to them. But sometimes it's because they've discovered that actually owning businesses can act as a glue for families. And that's quite an important motivator as well.
Well, yes, the challenge for the industry is the large firms want to scale, and scale is sort of inimical to tailoring and intimacy. So how do you think you're going to achieve continued differentiation in a very congested industry?
Yeah, one of the things that we're really clear about is that it's possible to build a scalable investment platform, but that we think it's potentially not possible to build a scalable client service platform, because client service ultimately is about people. And it's actually about hiring some really talented people who are interested in getting into the weeds with our clients and helping them resolve the individual client service issues that crop up. That piece we think is absolutely not scalable, but we are absolutely committed to maintaining that level of service, not least because we have two wealth owners in the firm in the form of Khalid Saeed and Sheldon Carvalho, who's our chairman, and they do not want to see that dip in any level. So we are completely committed to this course. So yes, I think it'll be number of clients in the end rather than assets that will cap us out.
So changing tack, we've had a lot of female guests running important parts of financial services, but we haven't talked about what it's like being a female client in what is often a muscular, male, jargon-driven industry. How do you think about that?
I think for the first probably 6-7 years, we had a majority of female clients. And I mean, I have absolute empathy with people who are just frustrated with dealing with our industry. I think very easily, money becomes the client rather than the individual becoming the client. And that, I think, is really a problem for us all to think about. So by us all, I mean families as well as investment managers. You come across families where the money is almost another character in the family. You know, it's another individual sitting at the family dinner table. And it's actually the most important member sitting at the family dinner table. And it's the one that gets all the attention. And I think many women particularly don't feel that they have the right to say, hold on a minute, this is about me, not about this pot of capital that's being held offshore. This is about me. And we do have clients who come to us with tremendous amounts of structuring and all put in place with the best possible intentions. But perhaps it's been there for 10 years and perhaps it's a little bit no longer fit for purpose. And the clients are wrapped up in it and they no longer have the freedom that they would have had. It comes back to our job being, our job is service and our job is to serve the individual, not to serve the money.
And if you could give one piece of advice to a wealthy family, what might it be?
I would say keep your eye on the long term and make sure that your liquidity has always been carefully matched by your managers.
And before we go to some general questions, when you are kept awake at night thinking about the world of investing, what is worrying you that could unfold in the next few years that will make this job particularly hard?
I think we're already seeing some concerns around where yield is going to come from. And we've been living in this low yield environment for a while now. And I think it's hard to see where that is going to change. The risk there, I think, is that we know as managers that the risk return ratio is very, very flat at the moment. Extra risk does not bring you extra return at the moment and potentially for the next period of time. So the risk is, I think, that clients and investment managers will scrabble for return because returns have been sort of baked into the offer and that risk will be taken that clients shouldn't be taking.
What is your ideal day when you're not working?
Yes, when I'm not working, what I would really like to be doing is actually just putting on my trainers and walking around London. I've lived in London really all my life, and there's still so many bits of it I don't know. But it's actually the back streets for me where the interesting bit is. And there's a particular sort of atmosphere in London at times that you almost catch a glimpse of Dickens sort of darting around a corner down an alleyway.
Final question, Charlotte. Who's your favourite author and favourite book?
I think my favourite author has to be Dickens. I haven't read every Dickens, but I've read most of them. But probably out of them all, David Copperfield and Great Expectations are just for me particularly lovely. And really because they're both the stories of sort of young, kind of quite lonesome men making their way in the world, but with sort of joy and optimism alongside them. I just find them kind of moving and lovely and also fun.
I am also a Dickens fan. So the question that one has to ask oneself, if he was commenting on today's global situation, would he say it was in fact the best of times and the worst of times?
It does feel like that, doesn't it?
But it does. What advice would you give to the young and to students thinking about career choices? Because you've done public, private, and you've held some different roles, your perspective might be particularly helpful.
One thing I would say is actually, look, most things are interesting. I mean, even from the outside, they might sound incredibly boring. If I say to you SERPs, pension policy, that's incredibly boring. But actually, when you're in it, when you're under the bonnet, and when you're looking at the challenges within it, it's not boring. It's interesting. So don't go for what you think sounds most exciting and glamorous, because actually, once you're in it, everything is interesting if you're properly in it and you're properly engaged with it. And everything is interesting if you do the other thing, which is try to work with really talented people. So this is why I wouldn't particularly worry about what sector you're in. Just try and work with really talented people. That's what you get from working in the Treasury. It's what you get from working in this end of the investment management industry. Working alongside really talented people who see things differently and can help you do a better job. I've been working with my two sort of fellow founding partners now for nearly 20 years, and we're still talking, still interested in what we each have to say, still have different perspectives. And I think that I couldn't have said at 21 leaving university that that would be the most important thing to aim for. But if you manage to find interesting, talented people, just stick with them.
And is that the same or different to the advice you give to a 20-year-old Charlotte Thorne?
Well, what I needed to do, which I didn't do very well, and I'm belatedly learning to be better at this, is actually stay in touch with people more. I'm not the most sociable person. I'm a bit of a homebody. And actually, it's incredibly valuable to be connected. I become more sociable as I get older. But I think I would say that to myself. Look, just remain connected with people and remain interested in and open to people and keep those connections going through your life. Because when you get to obviously this time in your life, you see that actually it's all about the people.
I agree. Now, you've worked in politics, you've worked in business. Who are the two people that you haven't met you'd most like to have dinner with?
Well, I would love to have dinner with Tony Blair, who sort of left office somewhat on a high and has since been sort of cast out. I'd love to hear what he has to say about the situation that we're in now. And then in terms of business, well, I would actually really like to meet Martha Lane Fox. She strikes me as someone who has been able to build a career in a pretty technical area, but then move on to working in areas that are really quite interesting. You know, her work that she's doing at the moment on digital exclusion, I think is really interesting. So I'd love to talk to her and hear how she made the various decisions that she's made along the way.
Well, she did a great podcast with Andy Coulson, whose crisis podcast series we've mentioned before here and is really terrific. Secondly, and rather surprisingly, the second person to mention Tony Blair, we had Jack Edmondson from Oxford University Endowment. And the reason he would be interested to meet Tony Blair was dealing with resilience. So I can see we need to organise something here. So Charlotte, I've really found this terrific conversation. You're obviously Capital Generation Partners is doing some really interesting work and thinking about that whole space, having done it for a long time, very thoughtfully and with some different nuances and approaches. And I'm going to take two observations away, which is particularly for the wealth management industry, too often money becomes the client, not the individual. And secondly, a much more general observation, which I think is super valuable, which is stay in touch with people throughout your life because it becomes increasingly important later on. So with that, Charlotte, I'm going to thank you once more for your time and your thoughts. And well, enjoy the rest of the summer.
Thank you, Simon. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.